Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program about social media. We want to welcome all of our guests here this evening and invite you to join us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs that are held here at the Commonwealth Club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. John Blossom founded Connecticut-based Shore Communications in 1997. The firm specializes in research advisory services and strategic marketing consulting for publishers and content service providers in enterprise and media markets, as well as for major corporations and startups. As one of the most widely recognized content industry analysts, John provides thought leadership to executives in search of new approaches to rapidly changing markets for publishing and technology products and services. He speaks widely at industry events and is quoted extensively in the business media, including the Wall Street Journal, Information Today, CEO Magazine, eContent Magazine, and many, many more. John is author of the book Content Nation, Surviving and Thriving as Social Media Changes Our Work, Our Lives, and Our Future. He argues that through social media, citizen publishers are fundamentally changing how people relate to each other in their personal, business, and community lives, and how social media's non-hierarchical information flow will alter human civilization. In 2007, John's content blogger weblog won the Software and Information Industry Association's 2007 CODI Award for Best Media Blog. John's career spans more than 20 years of marketing, research, product management, and development in advanced information and media venues, including the marketing and development of information services at global firms. John's extensive experience includes strategic assignments with the executive management team of Reuters Group PLC. He was a key player in a number of groundbreaking internet-oriented initiatives at Reuters, including the introduction of content management services and a global effort to integrate internet-based information suppliers into the mainstream Reuters information services environment. He has a BA in English from Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut, and has completed postgraduate studies in a number of fields, including management, marketing, structured systems analysis, and advanced communications networks. Please join me in welcoming John Blossom.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you, members of the Commonwealth Club, friends, curious people, and citizens of Content Nation. Welcome. For those of you who are interested in putting out messages on Twitter for this, I suggest you use the tag Content Nation, pound Content Nation. And for those of you who wonder what that is, don't worry. This is the book. I understand it's going to be on sale outside after our presentation here tonight, and I'd be glad to sign a copy if you'd like. It's published by John Wiley, came out in January, and it's a thrill to have written it. What I did, I wrote it online. I wrote it as a wiki at contentnation.com, solicited feedback as I was writing it, and got information included into it from people who were enthusiastic about Content Nation and social media in general. So it's a book that truly has grown up from Content Nation itself. So I'm here to tell you about social media and what Content Nation is about and what it means today for media, business, education, government, politics, and society. And those are kind of the headline topics that I cover in the book itself. And I'll talk about what social media really changes and what it means for our future. And if you've had a chance to read the book, when I say future, I mean future. And we'll get into that. So here we have this thing. The world is a nation of publishers. We have this thing called Content Nation that has come to life. And I figured out exactly what this meant a little while ago when I was doing some research. I am an industry analyst, so I look at numbers, I crunch them, and I say, And I came across some numbers from the Pew Internet Research studies that they put out on a regular basis and put them together with some other data I was getting from McCann Universal and some other sources. And I began to scale out some very interesting numbers. One of the numbers that came out of a Pew study said 27% of people who are blogging really want to influence other people through their blogging. And I said, well, that's interesting. It was a national study. I scaled it up to a global number. turns out that if you look at it globally, that means there are about 59 million people who really want to influence other people through weblogging. That's about as many people as in South Korea, the 24th largest nation in the world. So I said, well, that's interesting. Let's take it another notch here. Let's go up to lots of social media. Let's include everybody that's doing social networking. If you look at everybody that's social networking, 27% of everybody doing that is 74 million people. That's the 16th largest nation in the world, about as many people as in Turkey. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If we put in everybody that's doing comments on things and what have you, it potentially could scale up to as many as 300 million people who are really trying to influence the world. But just taking that 74 million, if each one of those people just trying to influence 20 unique individuals, they would influence everybody on the web today, about 1.4 billion people. The world is a nation of highly influential publishers. We're a global nation of citizen publishers, and we've taken over the stage. This is a picture from the recent Super Bowl, and Bruce Springsteen was performing on the field of the stadium there. And there's a phenomenon that people call cell phone encores now. People are snapping pictures and speaking with their friends and creating content about somebody who's a media star. In fact, we are the media stars. Thousands of people were publishing there at that event. We are a global nation of citizen publishers, and we are the world of publishing at this point. So to bring it a little bit down to earth, what is social media? I'm going to talk a little bit about that and talk about the seven secrets of social media, kind of the tip of the iceberg stuff from the book, and then we'll get into where I think Content Nation is leading us towards the future. First of all, what is this wonderful word phrase that we hear all the time, social media? Means a lot of different things to different people. This is my take on it, and it's a relatively simple definition. The ability for anyone to influence others easily using highly scalable and accessible publishing tools. And that word influence is key to me. But it's also important to remember this high scalability and accessibility. Anybody can walk up to the web and potentially influence the world. It means to me weblogs, wikis, social networking tools, people sharing videos, photos, podcasts, messaging services, microblogging services such as Twitter, forums, chats, collaboration, and even things that we take for granted oftentimes, things such as ratings and reviews on sites like Amazon and comments on weblogs. Anytime we're trying to influence the world with our publishing, to me, that is social media. So, you know, what is the secret sauce of social media? What makes it tick? And in the book, I suggest seven secrets, and it's like anything else that a consultant comes up with. It sounds good in a presentation, and there's a lot more to it. Would somebody tell me what's going on with the slides? There we go. It's all about the ability of people to scale their influence independently. This is a quick clip of one of the more important events in the last couple of years. Saddam Hussein was the captive of the most powerful nation on the earth in a sovereign state. And they went to execute him. They wanted it private. They didn't want to publicize. They wanted to control this as carefully as possible. So a sovereign state and the most powerful nation in the world were thwarted by one person with a cell phone equipped with the ability to record video. And that person that day decided to be a citizen of Content Nation and publish that to the world. We have global the influence. We have the ability to overturn the opinion of the nation's most powerful governments. It also means local influence, the ability to influence what happens at a human scale. The service Carrot Mob tried an experiment here in San Francisco not too long ago. They decided to see, can they make citizens actually change behavior in their own communities? And they polled local stores not far from here in about a 3 or 4 block area, and they tried and they had them bid on an opportunity to have their appliances made more energy efficient by people coming to their store and committing to a certain percentage of their sales from the day that people showed up to green energy. So Carrot Mob organized this. Hundreds of people showed up to the store that won this bid, and they practically sold out everything wall to wall in the store. And the store had easily enough money left over from those sales to convert all of their appliances and equipment to high energy efficiency. We have local influence through Content Nation's ability to form opinions about what happens in our own communities. We also have what I call real-time influence. I grew up on Wall Street with Reuters, watching traders look at real-time quotations from stock exchanges. Now the ability to communicate as events occur to people around the world is given to us by social media. In last year's Shenzhen earthquake, it was an enormous earthquake, and hundreds of people, as soon as the earthquake hit, began to put out messages on social media services such as Twitter to let the world know instantly that this enormous event had happened in a very remote province of China. It took a long time for global media to get to the scene of what was happening there, but in the meantime, Content Nation had influenced the world and let them know that something very important had happened. We also have influence over things that have traditionally been in the hands of other people, such as brands. You may have been hearing about something called Coke and Mentos. You take a bottle of soda, you put a Mentos mint candy into it, any soda that has some sort of gooey fluid in it, and the soda starts shooting out like a rocket from that bottle. And there was a fellow that's put a video of this on the internet a while back. People started saying, wow, this is cool. And hundreds and eventually thousands of people began to make videos of Coke and Mentos bottles shooting out this stuff. And they got even more inventive. Eventually, kids like this decided to say, hey, wait a minute. We don't want this stuff going up. We want to make rockets that take off. So this kid whams it on the ground and pew, up the thing goes up about 30, 40 feet like a rocket. And eventually hundreds of people were getting together to shoot off these fountains at the same time. And eventually the world record, I think, was about 3,000 people simultaneously in Latvia were doing Coke and Mentos fountains, sponsored eventually by the companies that figured out that people were running away with their brands, and they better do something about that. So Mentos and eventually Pepsi-Cola got involved in sponsoring these events. Our enthusiasm or our negativity about events can have global impact. We also have influence on the other direction. What actually goes into things that are created? Product influence is key in Content Nation. Dell, major computer company, decided that they would put up a social media portal to solicit ideas about their products and ask people, well, what would you really like? And they made it possible through the portal for people to look at these ideas and to vote for the ones that they thought that were best. They got, within just several weeks, 20,000 ideas for products. And the top ideas from those products they began to put into the production queue at the rate of about 5 or 6 a week. So all of a sudden, Content Nation is telling corporations directly what it is that we want in our products. It also means political influence. And I do have a chapter on politics in Content Nation. And I'm so proud I did not mention any political party by name in the entire chapter so that we could look objectively at everything that people are doing. But across the political spectrum, people are beginning to understand that we need to talk to citizens as citizens using the citizens' media. Congressman John Culberson is one person who's learning to do this using the Twitter messaging service. He caused quite a storm last year, sending out messages on his cell phone and other mobile devices from the floor of Congress. The Speaker of the House was going bananas. What does this mean? We have the congressional record. What are you doing? We have the media. What are you doing? He was trying to influence people, and at the same time, people were trying to influence him and other politicians through social media. He learned to become a citizen of Content Nation, and I was fortunate enough to speak with him last Friday in Washington on a panel on social media, and it was quite a thrill. He's a crackerjack expert in his field. So influence is extremely important. I don't know what eventually will happen with our technology here, but hopefully it works. But social media is secret number two. Technology matters in social media, but it's not as important as understanding what people are seeking to gain from influential publishing. You know, the question is, what's on people's minds? What are the human motivations for publishing? There are a lot of different motivations in social media. And one of the motivations is social contact. So we have a service such as CitySense that will take information that people are sending in via messages and find out, where's the hot scene in San Francisco tonight? Where should I go? Where are my friends? It's all mapped out on a service like CitySense. So there are very human goals oftentimes in social media that are met through collaborative publishing through peers. There are other types of mixtures of goals, however, and one of the phenomena that we have in social media is the mixing of personal and professional goals. This weblog is by one of the top technologists in the United Kingdom, and she's a blogger that combines her personal observations on life with her observations about her professional interest in technology. And people like the mixture of learning about what she does on a personal level as well as a professional level. So as a multidimensional human being, people appreciate the qualities of what she is. So this mixture of personal professional goals is one of the keys that is very different from what we've seen in traditional media up to this point. Social media secret number three, it's not about the law of the jungle as much as people think that social media can be a very scary thing. To me, it's about a very old institution, the campfire, where values matter in close-knit societies, and having people who are willing to enforce values really matters. There is sometimes a certain cowboy atmosphere in social media, but the most successful social media communities have people that enforce community values. One of the communities that does that is Newsvine, which is a social media community where people can collect and author news and opinion. And they have something called the Newsvine Code of Honor. And there are very six clear rules that people are supposed to follow. If you don't follow the rules, your peers in the community are going to raise their hands, and they'll notify the Newsvine staff. And if the Newsvine staff doesn't like what you're doing, you're out, either for a while or permanently. And that's exactly what happens in any normal human society. Society values are a part of social media and are reflected in social media in successful communities. We see that even in communities such as Twitter, where people are sometimes go in there with false intentions. Twitter picks up on that, and if people are going out there to try to sell you steak knives or what have you, you're gone too. So bit by bit, we are creating a reflection of our human values in social media. Social media secret number four, it creates millions of influential and highly scalable and valuable context for content, far more than provided by conventional media. There are thousands of tools that are used to create social media today. The Museum of Modern Betas, which is one weblog that tracks many of the latest developments in publishing tools, track about 5,600 new tools for publishing, most of them social media tools, in 4 years. Think of how many tools that existed for publishing in the last five centuries, and think of what that means for the potential of humanity. And it's tools on top of tools as well. We have the ability to, what they say, mash up content, to take content from multiple sources and to put it together to create new social context for content. Here's a simple mashup that's taking information from eBay and putting it into a Google map. So people who are trying to sell things themselves, in this instance houses on eBay, can have it put into another application that makes it easy to see where's the where, what communities are hot for real estate and which are not. So not only do we have the ability to publish content, we have in social media tools the ability to aggregate it and to form it into new valuable contexts. And the contexts play out on many different levels. They're contexts for individual people, such as myself and millions of others with Facebook accounts, but they're also organizations that have the ability to form contexts in social media to set up relationships with other people. Pink is a brand of Victoria's Secret that's aimed towards young ladies. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are fans of Pink the way they're fans of their friends on Facebook. So brands can find a peer context for themselves in social media if they learn how to be a member of that community the same way other people are. Organizations that are trying to make a different type of impact in the world can do that as well. The Buddhist monks in Burma, also known as Myanmar, were trying to get the oppression in their country noticed by the world, and they had a hard time until they started using social media. Using social media tools such as Facebook, weblogs, videos, they got the word out to the world what was happening in their country. And they keep, and the monks keep in contact with people through tools such as Facebook, where hundreds of thousands of people are kept up to date and telling their friends what's happening. So we can create valuable context for organizations that let people know that our influence is influencing the world. Social media secret number five, it trumps mass production's productivity with mass contextualization for millions of highly focused peer communities and markets. And I think this is really one of the more important economic things that's happening, but also a social impact as well. Any community can go out there and can create social media content. In this instance, it can be Native Americans who are trying to maintain their culture of music and recording of videos of their events to keep Native American culture alive. It can be truckers out on the road who are trying to keep in contact with one another. It used to be citizens' bands radios. Now they get to use weblogs, videos, share music through a site like mylayover.com. It can be in the enterprise, such as at a major store chain such as Best Buy, where they have something called Blue Shirt Nation, where employees have their own social network community in a private community where they can keep in touch with people at their network of stores so that all their people can learn from what people are doing at the grassroots level without waiting for upper management to learn to tell them about what's happening elsewhere. They keep their organization more intelligent and more profitable themselves through social media. It could be people in Pakistan who are beginning to learn on their own through a social media portal such as Orkut, what does it mean to have opinions about what your country's military is doing and to share them with one another? The openness of global social media tools enables that to happen. There's a flip side to this, of course. There's also the openness to allow organizations such as Al-Qaeda to be able to recruit people and to have their own forums for their views. So any community, even ones that we may not agree or feel comfortable with, can use social media. And, of course, we can do it right in our own backyard using tools such as nowpublic.com that allow citizens to gather together and to create news stories about events in their own community, such as a major fire in downtown Vancouver, and to have crowdsourced news that tells people what's happening through text, through video, and through interviews. Where I think this leads us is to a more robust economic model for the world. You may have heard of Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail, where he talked about search engines enabling hits in music and other mass-produced items, CDs and what have you, being kept alive economically through search engines. Well, you know, the long tail is important to be able to keep a mass economy going, but I think what we're looking at with social media is a mix of economic models that I call the big sombrero. If you look at a sombrero,
you've got that crown at the top of the sombrero. Think of that
as the mass economy, similar to the long tail. But if you look at that big wide brim of the sombrero and you look at the area underneath it, you put the area underneath the brim together, it's at least as big as what's happening in the crown. That's another way of saying that small to medium-sized economies that are not mass-oriented survive and thrive because of social media, looking at how people can create markets on eBay and other tools. So I think what we're seeing is the ability of social media to sustain long-lived social economies that have been challenged by mass market economies. And I think that's going to help us in the long run to build global and local social economies for any size enterprise. So local businesses and niche businesses that want to scale up globally are going to do very well through social media. Number six, social media's personally contextual content establishes more influential direct relationships between people who can help one another to survive and thrive. A CEO can put out a weblog, and their salesperson could be banging their head against a wall. Another CEO reads it. They pick up the phone and they say, "Peggy, I read what you said. I understand. We need to talk." All of a sudden, simply by putting your views out there, you can break through and build personal influence where influence was difficult to build before. It also allows people in the big sombrero economy to go out there and get helped to grow on scales that were difficult to sustain before. There's a concept of microloans that encourages people in developed countries that are relatively affluent to loan people in very small businesses in developing nations and in the United States to give them loans of small amounts such as hundreds or just a few hundred dollars to help them buy the equipment that they need to be able to grow their businesses and to have those loans managed in similar to what a commercial bank used to do for small businesses. These portfolios of loans have been very successful in helping very small entrepreneurs be able to sustain their businesses. So we have the ability not only on a small local level, but to allow the concept of locality to all of a sudden embrace the world, to have people all around the world support local communities through this type of economic stimulation. Number seven, social media's influence may be broad or narrow, long or short, but its value almost always benefits people who know how to have and listen to conversations. Ask and you shall receive. Scott Monty is a PR consultant, works with Ford and what have you. He got hosed on a hotel in New York City, and he was running out of time. He sent out a message on Twitter about 5 in the afternoon, "I need help. Can anybody help me?" Within moments, he got messages from dozens of people suggesting hotels, including one from a hotel reservation specialist who within 15 minutes got him a very reasonably priced reservation at one of the better hotels. It was only about a 5-minute walk from where he was standing, simply because he asked for help. So, you know, our ability to get out there and to simply ask our community for something and to get things gets us responses. We don't always necessarily get the responses that we want in social media, though. And the Barack Obama campaign discovered that in the 2008 election. They opened up their portal to allow people to blog whatever they would want and comment on whatever they would want to comment. Well, some of the blogs and comments included comments from people who were opposed to some of the policies that Barack Obama's campaign was promoting, including his stance on the FISA Wiretap Act. So when you say that you want openness and discussion in social media, be ready to have a conversation with people that may not necessarily be what you had hoped for. So that's kind of the quick précis of what Content Nation is about, give or take. And there are lots of examples that are given in the book. If you're looking for, you know, what really happens in business, what happens in marketing and politics, lots of case studies. But the fun part, I think, of Content Nation is when you start to wander towards the end of the book. Because I begin to paint a picture of where social media is really taking us. And I believe that social media is far bigger a trend than most of us can imagine. I think it's truly realigning the bonds of human society. It's returning us to more flexible forms of human organization, and it's extending our ability to evolve human civilization itself. Publishing is not something special. To be able to publish is something very essentially human. There was a company in India that had an office in New Delhi that was technology-oriented, and they decided to try an experiment they called the hole in the wall. There was an alley next to the building in a neighborhood where there are very poor people living, lots of poor children running around, no education, no knowledge of anything, really. They put a PC in the side of the building, allowed the kids to be able to touch the screen, touch a keyboard. And the kids, with absolutely no knowledge of what a computer was, much less how to use it, learned how to surf the web, to start to create content, and to teach one another how to do things together, creating content. It's essentially a human thing. We know how to publish. It's a part of our DNA. And it's a joy to publish. When Matt Harding went out and did the Where the Hell Is Matt video, this is a young man who went out and decided to dance around the world. He had a goofy little dance that he learned somewhere along the way, and he decided to dance with people all around the world, in India, in China, in North Korea, at the DMZ. He danced in all these goofy places. He went to Papua New Guinea to dance with the headhunters. And everybody danced with him. We all love to be publishers. It's part of what we are. So what I see happening with social media and the promotion of publishing tools, such as the one laptop per child here project shown here in India, we are reclaiming humankind's heritage as natural publishers. As we go from hundreds of millions to a billion to more than billions of people who are equipped with global publishing tools, we're creating a whole new scale of campfire for human civilization. And if we think back to that Museum of Modern Beta's listing and all those thousands of tools, if we think what happened with human civilization through tens and hundreds of thousands of years, if we look at the human record, when you saw a profligation of tools, humans changed, and sometimes their DNA changed. That's the scale of human change that we're beginning to see with social media. And that means that we can start to do things with human society that we've been neglecting for a long time. There are about 6.7 billion people in the world today. And if I'm off by a few hundred million people, excuse me, there are a heck of a lot of people out there, and only about 1.6 billion of them are on the web today. What about the other 5 billion? Here we have mass market technology that is really good at creating pounds and piles of stuff that goes into landfills where disposable people try to make a living. There's something fundamentally wrong about this on a moral scale, but I think that it's also fundamentally wrong in terms of what we're able to do with human civilization through publishing. So when I see tools such as Google Notice Board beginning to come into the world that will enable any village around the world to be able to have communal publishing, even if they don't have the ability to write any sort of literacy, they can speak in their own natural tongues and dialects into the Google Notice Board and share information with other people in their community and people who are able to communicate with them in their own tongue. I think the real revolution that is just beginning in social media is the other 5 billion people that are about to be empowered as publishers. The world is going to change far more than we can imagine once those people are full citizens of Content Nation. What I think this means ultimately is that we are in the process of changing civilization's DNA. To me, publishing defines the organism we call society. You change publishing, and you change how society can adapt and evolve. And one of the keys to this that I talk about in the book is something called altruism. Now, we think of altruism as goody-goody sometimes, but in his book, Nicholas Wade wrote a book, Before the Dawn, that talked about early humans and how we came from animals and turned into humans. And he talks about human altruism is one thing, animal altruism is another. In fact, there is altruism amongst animals such as chimpanzees, in part because of their reproduction habits. They're never quite sure who's related to who. So if you have a group of about 40, 50 chimpanzees and they're attacked, if that chimp over there, you know he's not your brother or sister, but he might be related. And they'll cooperate and defend one another against attacks, even if they're not directly in their gene pool. So you might be related to me, so I'll cooperate. That type of altruism is encoded in our genes, and it's about the genetic survival of a small group. And it's focused on flexible, collaborative social adaptation. You own the moment. The threat comes and goes, and then you're not quite sure what you're going to feel about that person. Human altruism is different. I believe human altruism is based on publishing and formed at the dawn of civilizations. When we went from having just small trading with small groups of people to large trading, we started losing track of things. We had to write down who promised what to whom, and writing was born. And I think human altruism is about saying, you know, we have a social or business contract, and it's written in stone if you were an emperor like Hammurabi, so we'll cooperate. The Steel of Hammurabi was a large, tall listing of laws written in cuneiform that people would reference. And if you did X, Y, or Z, you would lose your head, your arm, your life. And that kind of was natural selection, you might say, for the organism of society. It created this bigger than a human thing called civilization. So the DNA of civilizations, such as Babylon, were encoded in publishing. Well, it's kind of inflexible and centralized ownership of things, though, and it created social organisms that adapted relatively slowly to change. And Babylon, for, you know, all its glory, lasted less than 1,000 years. You see, they had a problem. They thought it was great to irrigate land, and that helped their civilization flourish, and they just kept on irrigating. That's what their social DNA said that they should do, go out and irrigate the land. Well, within about 5 or 6 centuries, the land started to get pretty salty, and about 800 years after Babylon started, everything started to turn to salt. You go out to the deserts of Iraq today, it's a plain of salt, and within 1,000 years, the empire that was known as Babylon disappeared. Well, the sad part is, here we are in the 21st century, and we're no smarter. This is a graph of what's happening out in the Central Valley here in California. The same geology, the same salinization of the land. The Central Valley is turning to salt. And it will be, if it's not stopped, at the same point that Babylon is, not in 1,000 years, but 70 years. So there's something about central publishing that creates this inflexible thing called civilization that seems hell-bent on killing itself. Nature, fortunately, does better. The coelacanth fish has been around for more than 100 million years. It knows how to survive. It knows how to adapt. DNA is a lot smarter about what it takes in order to survive. Humans are just beginning to learn. So I think social media is a way of rewriting society's DNA, bringing the best of natural and the best of technology together. It means decentralized control of publishing, peer bonds, collaboration, real-time ability to solve problems, contextuality rather than mass generalization, and it's transactional. We execute things together. You know, we're leveraging technology and humanness through social media to create rapidly adapting and highly scalable civilizations. Social media doesn't mean one mass civilization that's going to happen. We're going to have a multiplicity of civilizations being reborn. We're going from this machine that we've called publishing to the world being a publishing organism. That is what I call the censor society. We're all part of this network of social media. We're all points on the censor map. We're all contributing and sharing what's happening out there in the world today and creating this rich fabric of knowledge together that allows us to create flexible relationships with one another to survive and thrive. A good example of what this means from a genetic standpoint, there's a relatively new game called Spore. They were preparing it last June or so, and they came out with a tool that allowed people to design critters and to say, well, what should their DNA look like? On a playful level, it didn't get down to millions of things you could manipulate, but you could do all sorts of things to create your own critters with this little piece of software they did. So they decided, let's have people design their critters and share them with one another before the game launches, so there'll be like a library of beings that people can look at. And they figure, well, maybe by September when the thing launches, 100,000. Within a few weeks, they got over 1.5 million creatures designed. By the time the software was launched in September, 3 million. That's twice as many creatures that exist in the world today. That's how creative we are at figuring out how to survive and thrive using publishing tools. I do believe that social media gives us more chances to adapt to changing conditions. And the world is changing. I won't go into global warming things. And if you read the book, I have a scenario about radical change to our climate that has nothing to do with the current political debate. I won't give it away. But things are changing. We're probably, within a few centuries, heading more towards ice ages than anything else. The world isn't going to look the same. Where you and I are standing is not going to be the same. What I think that means is that human society and civilization is going to have to change on a much more radical scale. I believe that technology is going to keep the pace with it, though. I think we're going to have organic technology that will grow networking, that will enable the world to communicate with one another on an ongoing, sustainable basis. And I believe if you look 50, 100, 1,000, 10,000 years into the future, social media will be a physical part of who we are. Our tribes will be anywhere and everywhere. And our relationships will extend with one another via social media content through the ages. You got to read chapter 10. It's totally cool. So we're kind of going back to our Ice Age roots in a lot of ways. You know, our ancestors chased the mammoth. And when you're chasing the mammoth, context is everything. This mammoth code for social media, let your content graze where it needs to. Think about how people chase their meals. And we're going away conceptually from agriculture in a lot of ways via social media. Study its behavior carefully. A lot of analytics and social media are key to its success. Be prepared to chase it. Chase your contexts. Bring friends and family. You're going to need help to succeed in social media. Build your social networks. Build collective wisdom. Share in the hunt. Don't be selfish. Use everything, because everything in social media has enormous value, more than we can imagine. And be ready to switch to alternatives. When you don't like Portal X, you're going to be going to Portal Y to survive and thrive in social media using the thousands of tools that are available to us. The world is a nation of publishers. And I hope that you have the proud standing of being a citizen and content nation. Wear your flag proudly, because you're part of a global trend that is changing civilization today. That's me. That's my company. We help people make money doing this sort of thing. Come talk to me about that sometime. It's been a privilege to speak to you tonight. Thanks.
I want to thank John Blossom for speaking to us tonight about social media, and it's becoming increasingly pervasive and transformational. And we'll move into a period now of Q&A, so if you do have a question, please get that ready, and I'll lead off here, if I may. John, it all seems so overwhelming, frankly, and it seems like we've been into information overload for a number of years here, with communications being more global, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And as you start off, you're talking about the whole notion of influence. It's kind of like, gee, if you have something good to say and you say it well, get out there and say it. Or even if you don't, I mean, there's so many different ways, in other words. And that conjures up imagery of talking at people to me. And then later on, you certainly talk about the conversational aspects of it. But if we got everybody out there blogging and we're all yakking, it's kind of like, is anybody listening? And then and this is what I'd like you to address, if you would talk a little bit about. So as we think of transforming civilization, which is what you're offering up here and so forth, which over the coming decades and maybe centuries, whatever, but how do we listen and how do we learn? In other words, as we talk about hierarchy of data, information, knowledge, and wisdom, and if information is that which changes us, and if this social media allows me to get all kinds of information from video and otherwise, and I get into information overload, how do we listen and learn? And how does this really promote conversation? Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure thing. I suppose along those lines, it's kind of intuitive that I had this. I tossed this into a deck from an earlier presentation. It's not really about information. It's about content. And to me, content is the information and experiences that benefit an audience in specific contexts. We've grown up in an era of information technology, and we think that we're in information overload. What we're really experiences is context underload. We don't have enough places where information is valuable enough to people. This is what Google started to solve. They began to say something very simple in their computer algorithms. What do people really care about? And that was the fundamental core of their PageRank algorithm. And stuff that people really cared about and told other people that they cared about by hyperlinking began to become more important. And I think that's one of the advantages that we're seeing in social media is that people that other people trust become their filters. So we see things such as in Twitter, to use a current example, of people monitoring specific people who are looking at news headlines or events and looking at their links and their comments on events. So in essence, what we're creating is community editorial boards, if you will, peer reviews, communities, if you will, that peer review everything that's happening in our lives. So we speak and we listen to the people that we trust. So when it comes to this question of, you know, gee, there's so many people yakking at us and throwing commercials at us and abicizers, whatever that thing is on the television, those are people that are talking at us. But social media allows us to filter those people out with the click of a button and to let us listen to the people that we really do care about and allows us to control a publishing community to say, guess what, you're propaganda, you're rude, you're sick. And to create communities of people that we trust to allow us to understand the world in a sensible way. And it can be scalable. It can be on a very intimate relationship. You can have a Facebook page that's just your family and a few friends. Or it can be somebody out there on Twitter with tens of thousands of people following you. So this ability to create that highly scalable community of trust, I think, is one of the powers that allows us to get beyond the broadcast shouting era and get to the listening era on many different levels.
Questions from the audience?
Hi. Could you name three brands that you think are doing an excellent job in social media and why you think they're doing a particularly good job?
I think brands are, in general, are beginning to catch up fairly rapidly. I think the scary thing about brands in general is that they try to figure out, how do we make this about seduction and not relationships? Because we've had generations of media being about seduction. Don't think. Filter out the things that might make you think contrary. Everything that you don't want to do, say, going into a marriage, if you're smart. And social media encourages people to be honest about things. I think Ford, as a major brand that's trying to build up the conversation, has done pretty well in both listening to customers and to speaking at them at a conversational level. I think they've done a pretty good job. In media, it's a lot tougher battle. They've been so used to being the experts for so long. The New York Times has been doing some more progressive things as of late to be able to converse with people. And there are a lot of things happening in the toy industry. I think especially products that are oriented towards younger people, such as Lego, are learning how to speak with people through social media, and also adults as well. You know, the adult enthusiasts for specific sort of recreational events, I think those are some of the communities that have thrived the most. The communities where you have people that are consuming products, where people are really hot on them and are willing to tell people what they think, seem to be the ones that are most easily harvested. And, you know, the Dell example is a fairly good one as well.
John, I wanted to just quickly ask you a nuts and bolts question. You mentioned 5,600-odd tools, mm-hmm. so that are out there related.
Right.
And perhaps many people in the room are bloggers already, and some of us over in the community where I live have tried to get a blog going. We've playing with TypePad as an example,
right.
And I think Blogger is free, and that you can get that going in a few seconds. But anyway, the point I'm getting to is that some may argue that blogs aren't necessarily that democratic in the sense that there's an author, or you can also have multiple authors, depending, again, on the software you're using. And then, of course, the whole world is open to make comments if you mm-hmm. enable that thing, if you enable commentaries. But comment, if you would, about this notion of blogs, I guess, as being a good, you know, democratic tool for starting an issues conversation, or are there better tools? Maybe kind of a nuts and bolts question, I guess.
Well, I wouldn't say the blogs have passed their peak, but I think that because there are so many different tools now for people to be able to establish conversations effectively, people who are using blogs tend to be people who like to write more. I think we're beginning to see longer and longer blog posts. So maybe I started out in the right place because I've always been kind of wordy. Blogs, however, can be configured and oftentimes are configured to allow the comments. So if you have something that's controversial, people can talk back to you. What happens, though, is that people who don't like people talking back to them sometimes edit or turn off the comments. And we saw a lot of that during the political season. There were some politicians, like the Obama campaign, that kept their blogging facilities very open to keep the conversations going. Other politicians kept it much more packaged. If you're going to be using social media tools, anything can put words out on the web. All a blog really is to use the technology terms, content management. It's a database that allows you to publish a page simply without having to know the technology behind it. So, you know, blogs can be used for any number of purposes, not necessarily things that are ultimately social media. If we look at, something like TechCrunch that tracks Silicon Valley technology and other technologies today, that's really not so different than any other newsletter or magazine in terms of the editorial content that's in the technology itself. So using any particular tool, be it a blog, be it Twitter, be it anything, is no guarantee that somebody's going to try to use it in a social media vein. It's how the person manages it and establishes the relationships that encourage people to contribute in a conversational way that makes the conversation. It's not the technology.
Other questions?
Yeah, this all sounds great, and it sounds optimistic and like it's going to make the world better and safer.
Right.
And I really hope so, and that's what
sometimes it will.
You project, but you sort of glossed over the Al Qaeda, the dark side can use this also. And is there something about social media that protects us from the, you know, the Stalins and Pol Pots and Hitlers? And is there anything there, or why can't they just use this to send you a text message and say, if you leave your house tonight, I'll kill you?
Well, it's a very good point, and I do dwell on some of the negative aspects of social media in the book. Society is us, and ultimately we allow society to be what we want it to be. If we want to have people control our media, then we'll have controlled media. If we want to have open media, then we'll have open media. You know, and one of the examples I give in the book is Tom Paine. During the War of Independence, Tom Paine was nobody. He had a little cash in his pocket, and he published a pamphlet. And eventually, about 100,000 copies of that were published. About the million odd people in the American colonies at that time, pretty much everybody read them in the taverns and restaurants of the era, inns of the era, and people made up their mind to do something. And I think that's what prevents that from happening in any media is us. The difference being in social media is since there's much less centralization of the publishing control, it's much more difficult for a Stalin or any other tyrannical figure to get a hold of individuals' opinions. It's much easier for people to get together and say, we don't feel comfortable with this, and to have that expressed immediately, oftentimes. So there's no guarantee that this results in democracy. It only means that it reflects what people are seeing at a particular point in time. And if people feel that they're afraid, they could still opt for tyranny. There's no guarantee. But I think we have better tools to prevent it with social media.
John, you've convinced me I'm going to buy the book. My question
That's
relates
a good thing.
To because you really spike some interest about in terms of social media and its role in the future of mm-hmm. civilization. But mine's more question is very specifically to do with the social media versus the traditional mainstream media, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a debate, and we're seeing, you know, we're hanging on by our claws here to the San Francisco Chronicle, and
yes.
there's, you know, they talk about not-for-profit, and because there has to be a place for news, you know, the facts to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know that, well, a lot know that Twitter has broken news. You know, the miracle landing on the Hudson was broken on Twitter, for example. So what do you see the role of the traditional mainstream media versus social media? Can they coexist?
I'm going to say it simply, and I don't mean to be glib by saying it simply. but to be good reporters. I believe that professional journalism will survive and thrive in an era of social media when there are individuals who are trained to know how to use the tools and to put their content in the right contexts. That's kind of a long way of saying that you may or may not be working for the Chronicle, but you're going to have a job, and you're going to make a darn good living if you have the right relationships and the right skills to tell the world's story. Great storytellers will always do well in telling stories. Great storytellers need to be a little bit more expert, however, in building the network of relationships that they may need outside of traditional media organizations. And we see that happen. If you think Michelle Malkin, just to take an example out of thin air, she was just a, you know, somebody working for a traditional news organization that went out and decided to do a weblog. Most powerful conservative weblogger by some people's estimate. And she did that just by deciding to be part of Content Nation. So, and I think that traditional news organizations will still be brilliant editors. They may be editing content from more different places than they used to. And I think that news organizations in general have to become better neutral aggregators of valuable content from different sources, use their technology in more efficient ways so that folks like you can have wonderful salaries.
Hi, I have a question about the private and public aspect of the social network. Mm-hmm. Social network on the web mostly are, as I understand, are more private circles, but there are more. Do you see those social network will be open, will be become more open and to the public?
I first have to challenge your first assumption. Social media networks can be both private and public, and a mixture. The tools can allow either and or both. And there are some social media networks, such as Facebook communities, that can be very tight-knit so that mom and dad and the kids can feel comfortable doing things. And that's great. Then you have things like Twitter. You put out your Twitter message, and the whole doggone world could see it. And so the technology doesn't necessarily reserve either model. What I think it does mean, though, is that people are learning to be more public, and you see this with the kids. You know, the kids are just sitting, they'll be sitting next to one another texting. You know, they're not talking, they're just kind of texting, and they're like laughing at one another's texts. You know, I do stuff with kids, and it's just amazing. But so I think the younger generation feels more comfortable with the mixture of public and private. I think some of us older people are a little uncomfortable with it at times. But social media can allow it to be both public and private. And I think oftentimes there is a mixture that's required for people to feel comfortable.
You mentioned in passing the importance of analytics.
Yes.
Could you say more about what they are, wow, and how they're used and why they're important? Please.
Just imagine, to put it simply, if you could understand what consumer sentiment was on your product right now. And you can do that with many, by mining the information on many social media tools. And that's what marketers are doing every moment of the day now. And they have real-time charts, graphs, semantic analysis tools that examine the language, examine what geographic area it's coming from. It just goes on and on. And it's allowing people to understand many different aspects of not just consumer goods, but political trends. All sorts of mining of social media is going on very actively these days.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes.
What are the methods to monetize social media? What are all the methods? Because lots of people still try to figure it out. It's a very hard one. Thank you.
Well, I like to use the simple phrase, I trust, therefore I execute. We're used to saying, I wrote this, therefore you're going to pay me. Well, you know, I hope you buy the book. You better buy the book. But a lot of the transactions are much more indirect. Social media helps us build relationships that become trustworthy. And oftentimes the execution is in a different venue or on a different level. I trust, therefore I'm going to marry you because I found you on Match.com. Maybe. You know, or I trust you because you wrote on the what you wrote on the blog, therefore I'm going to hire you. Or I trust you and therefore I'm going to make you that loan on MicroPlace. So there are different levels of transaction that happen in social media. It's not just about, I wrote these words, I am now going to pay you for the words. The words created value. The value is going to be monetized in different contexts for different people, depending on what they need at a particular point in time.
John, I know that we've got so many more questions, and if you have a moment after the event, I'm sure some people may want to ask you some further questions and perhaps sign a book or two. But I would like to give you just a couple of minutes, if you would, to summarize the one or two key things that you'd like us to leave with. What sort of thoughts come to mind that as we leave and contemplate this transformation of society over time, or maybe it's happening before our very eyes, but what couple of thoughts would you like to leave with us tonight?
Well, I think we need to look at the near term, I suppose, as a closing thing, since I talk so much about the long term. Here we are in a downturn economy. What's going to kick this economy into high gear? Maybe the billions that they're throwing at the large companies, but I think it's the small to medium business that is going to lead our economic recovery globally. So the more effectively, efficiently that we get social media tools into the hands of people who can create economic value at the bottom of the economic chain, out on the brim of the big sombrero, I think there's more hope that we can have a sustainable global economy that can rapidly meet supply and demand as we try to exit this bad economic cycle. To some degree, perhaps this economic cycle is a reaction to the growth of social media. All of a sudden, people just don't necessarily care about what they used to. I watch my high-definition television, at least I try to, but everything has a commercial in it. I don't like people yelling at me anymore. And social media tells me I don't have to have people yelling at me anymore. You know, I hope that Billy Mays goes on to, you know, a wonderful career somewhere, but stop selling me things, Billy Mays. So I think the message that I want to leave people with is that the conversations that we can create in social media have enormous value on so many different levels. If we focus on creating the ability to allow people to create as many different valuable transactions as possible for many different levels of the economy as possible through social media and give up on this idea of seduction advertising, we're going to create a lot more value from all the intelligence that's available to us.
We put our hands together for John Blossom, please. I want to thank John for presenting to us tonight about social media and its increasingly pervasive and transformational characteristics. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.